Okay, Chris.
All right. So I haven't indulged myself yet in this aspect. So before I get started, we're going to start with the most important. Okay, so that's Catherine in about 2 months. So I think some of you met her at the party.
Lisa Plot.
And if I'm lucky, she won't care. All right. So, going on to less important things. So this is a talk I gave this past week at the APS meeting with the main goal, well, at least I thought the main goal, was basically talking to Gravity Wave, the Gravity Wave community, and encouraging them to start thinking through or providing some motivation for their work in terms of what can you do with things like LISA besides gravity. Right? So there's astrophysics to be gotten out of observations that LISA will be doing if LISA ever flies. And so I wanted to try to walk through some of the things we might be able to do in terms of astrophysics of binary objects. And I'll be focusing on, you know, what I call generically white dwarf ultra-compact binaries. So these are systems that are essentially coalescing or inspiraling white dwarfs. Well, inspiraling white dwarf with something else that's a compact object that may or may not make contact and then come back out or survive the contact phase. So the outline of this presentation is basically providing an overview for the gravity wave people of the basics of the ultra-compact binary evolution. So some of this, for some of you, might be just a little rehash. I'll apologize in advance if it is. Hopefully I'll say something new and interesting. And then focus on basically open questions in terms of the formation and evolution of these systems, motivating the question of what can we do with LISA in terms of diagnosing and or helping to answer these open questions. So once I do that, I'll then talk about a couple pieces of physics that you might be able to get some information about using LISA observations that are relevant to answering said questions. So, all right, so ultra-compact binaries. So these are systems, by definition, with orbital periods below the hydrogen second binary with a hydrogen secondary minimum orbital period, so around 70 minutes, or if you want to, you know, 60 to 70 minutes. So the donors or the lower mass object in these systems has to be of evolved composition, helium or CO. So the basic evolution of these systems is displayed heuristically here in terms of the gravity wave strain trying to make contact with the gravity wave people versus orbital period. So you start out typically in a phase of inspiral, which is a detached system, moving up inward in orbital period and upward in strain amplitude. Right? Eventually, you get close enough so that the donor or the lower mass object in the system is able to start mass transfer. During the onset of mass transfer, there's a phase in all systems in which you can still move in orbital period for a bit, and it depends on the structure and nature of the donor. After this point, some of these systems will end up merging or doing something else that you'll remove them from the binary population, and then some subset of these will end up reaching a high enough mass transfer rate in a stable manner that you start evolving back out down along tracks that look like this. Basically, the lower strain as you reduce your chirp mass, as you transfer matter from the lower mass to the higher mass object, and outward in orbital period.
Chris, are these cycle average strains or one cycle strains or at least a lifetime strains? Or?
This is cycle average, I believe. Yeah.
Over
just an orbit.
Yeah, just the instantaneous strain.
Yeah, right.
Just a quadruple.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just something clinical.
All right, so then for the gravity wave people, I just wanted to give them some context for what these objects could be. And the accretor in these systems are either CO or helium white dwarfs. The donors or the lower mass objects can be CO white dwarfs, helium white dwarfs, or helium burning stars, typically. And by white dwarfs here, I'll just try to reemphasize the point that these are not necessarily fully degenerate objects. There's a range of parameters, a range of degeneracies with which these objects can be making contact. So it's not sort of an either or situation. And I'll try to highlight that in terms, so let me step back. it's not either or in terms of either a helium burning star or a fully degenerate white dwarf. There's actually a range of properties you can have in either of these with any of these donors, and I'll try to highlight that as we go through. That's sort of one of the main points of this whole presentation. Okay, and again, as most of us know, you basically see most of these systems in the mass transferring phase, just because they're slightly longer lived, but more importantly, accretion creating systems are much brighter generally, so they're easier to spot. So basically, we don't have a whole lot of information about systems coming inward in terms of direct observation, especially at these orbital periods, and we only have slightly more information observationally currently about the systems moving out.
Sorry, what's the dotted line?
The dotted line, okay. So this line is basically the point at which you fall behind the detached white dwarf-white dwarf confusion limit in LISA. So there's a large population of detached COCO white dwarfs that are sitting out in the galaxy that are just gonna be a noise foreground for most other systems. So once you get to this point, you're no longer gonna be able to be resolved as an individual system.
And are you distinguishing, when you say helium-burning stars, are you including that stars that have gotten too small and the helium-burning has gone out? Were helium-burning?
Roughly speaking.
Is that the distinction between helium white dwarfs and helium burning?
No. So the distinction between helium white dwarfs and helium burning stars are the helium white dwarfs make contact post a second common envelope, never having had the right conditions to ignite helium.
Okay.
Helium burning stars
at some time
burn helium.
But may so not be actively burning helium.
Right. So what they would, these would do would move into a CO white dwarf.
Yeah.
Although the properties at contact will depend on which channel you evolve to possibly. So we all have seen plots like this from LEV, which are a good, very good summary of sort of, you know, all the various.
This is the number two for most shown.
Yes.
Number one is 94. What's the supernova? 94D. Yeah, that's the most shown.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay, I'm going to get to another most shown, which I feel like sort of.
94D.
Yeah. With all the accretion rate versus.
Yeah, that's going to happen there too. Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, I haven't earned my wings yet, but I'll get to that later. So, in any case, basically, I won't go through all of this in any detail, but the whole point is basically start with a primordial main sequence binary, go through some hoops and tricks, and you eventually end up as something coming together as two, you know, white dwarf objects, or maybe a white dwarf and a helium star down here. This is the CV channel. But in any case, there's some stuff
which
missing.
Which links white dwarf?
Yes.
Helium
this was
star.
This was
that's the danger.
Yes.
Given the slide.
I actually covered. There's actually a white box covering that up. Only because trying to keep it simple. You know? This is a complicated mess, and you know, and that's the whole point of this, right? Primordial binary parameters, which I should highlight just so that I can argue for the relevance of stuff that we do as binary evolution. So in terms of where you get money nowadays, star formation, this is related to star formation, and down here, supernova. So we provide the middle ground, right? So in any case, these primordial binary, the distribution of primordial binary parameters is not necessarily, it's not well known. And then going from there down to here, fundamentally what you'd like to be able to do as a binary evolution, slow binary evolution theorist, is to say, aha, I start out with some parameters here and I can tell you exactly, you know, what's going to be happening by the time you get down to this phase in terms of parameters that matter to the evolution at contact and beyond. So in terms of the mass of the accretor, the donor, the radius of the donor, the composition of the donor, all of these things play into whether or not you turn into an AMCVN star or you blow up as a supernova, for example. And so you'd like to be able to actually write down this mapping. The point, though, right now is that from first principles, all of this is theoretically uncertain for several reasons. One of the main, as we all know, is the treatment of the common envelope. So question number one is, how do you go from here to here? And I don't know. Once you go from here to here, and I should say by parameters at contact, this is sort of a nice break point in terms of separating evolutionary stages. So once you get down here, there's also the question of what happens when you start the mass transfer process. So I'm talking about this in terms, or this slide is focusing on the proto-AMCDN. So these are objects in which you have a helium-dominated donor, whether it's a white dwarf or a helium star. The CO-CO objects, the lore is basically you come together, you merge, and you're done. So we'll just go with that for the time being as far as this talk is concerned, and focus on the helium-donating object or systems. So once you make contact, well, there's various things you can do. In some cases, you could end up having unstable mass transfer leading to a merger, which can produce, you know, either an isolated white dwarf or an object that's burning helium for a time. The binary might survive, and then, you know, a primary outcome of that is the AMCDN population. Again, maybe you'll end up igniting helium on the surface of the accreter.
Before you move on, if you could just remind us, for the COCO white dwarf, as they come closer and one of them fills its Roche lobe, what happens?
So the standard idea is that, well, everyone just assumes you get a merger, you know, because you want to produce some double degenerate, you know, channel, or you want to have that double degenerate channel for the supernova. But I think the physics of why you would expect a merger to happen is actually something I'm going to talk about later, and that's direct impact. Basically, let's say you have a proper mass ratio, so maybe a 1.1 and a 0.6, you know, that is, in the absence of anything else going on, actually something that would be stable at contact. You know, the mass ratio is right, and if you assume they're fully degenerate, you should get stable mass transfer. The thing, though, is that that configuration is so compact that you end up actually having an additional angular momentum sink. In terms of the accretion stream, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. So actually, can I answer that question a little bit later?
Sure, okay.
In terms of why you might expect things not to survive there. So binary survival, and then maybe, you know, things like type 1a supernova, as Lars talked about a little bit at the conference in March. And then in this entire process, there's a phase in which you could be doing helium shell flashes or helium nova on the surface of the accretor while you're going through the early stages of mass transfer. And again, though, we don't know from first principles exactly what's going to happen in all these cases. And there's some uncertainties in physics that set various outcomes. So what you'd like to do, since theory doesn't get it for you, I guess we have to, you know, appeal to observations. And you'd like to understand the distribution of these contact parameters as a way to leverage information about star formation and binary evolution processes. And two, you'd like to understand the outcomes of contact as a function of these parameters. So one thing you might envision doing is being able to say, okay, you lay down a theory, and I should be able to predict, based on that theory, how many stars turn into AMCDNs as functions of the parameters, how many mergers, you know, helium-burning primaries, and things that might be detectable as some thermonuclear explosions. So one way of saying it is that saying this is, I would like to be able to write down the branching ratios and have a suite of observational constraints that you can then start playing with to say, well, no, there's something wrong here, here, or here. So that sort of would be the grand goal of, you know, playing this game. So what do we know from observations? Well, not a whole lot. We only have, from electromagnetic observations, a total of about 16 or 18 of these AMCDN objects. And actually, I've been glossing over, just so we're all on the same page. An AMCDN is basically a white dwarf being accreted onto in a stable manner by a helium-dominated object. And the nature of that object, as I said, can vary a bit. So these are the systems, you can think of them as the objects that survive this contact phase, right, and are now in a stable mass transfer phase. All right. So we know of about 18 of them, okay? But in the last, I would say, 3 years or so, we've actually started to do, our observers have started to do a very good job of really pinning down the properties of many of the known systems. In particular, both the Nijmegen group and the Warwick group have really done a lot of good work in giving us information about where these systems lie. So now, you know, in the last year, we actually can put down a good number of these systems on this diagram of, you know, gravity wave frequency versus strain and say, with error bars, these are where these systems lie. You know, so it's no longer just they're in the right frequency band. We actually can say, if you fly LISA, you will see these systems. And these are where they, and these error bars are not going to move a whole lot. So you know, these systems will serve as verification sources for LISA in terms of, you know, if you don't see these, LISA's got problems. But in terms of trying to play this game that I've alluded to in prior two slides, 16 systems really aren't a whole lot to really do a well-determined characteristic of or providing detailed answers to these questions. So electromagnetic observations in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years in terms of galactic plane surveys are expected to turn up a factor of 40 to 50 more, which is great. But if you go to gravity wave observations, you're going to detect a whole lot more. So what this focus on, obviously, the red box, this upper histogram shows the distribution of, expected distribution of AMCVN systems currently in the galaxy. And then this, you can't really tell the different shading, but this lower, you know, second histogram shows the expected number of these systems that LISA will be able to detect.
What volume has been probed right now, you know, with them, and what do we think the spatial density is? I assume that that seems to go into creating these.
Yes. Let me give you those numbers offline. I don't remember off the top of my head what the space density, for example, is.
The highest number I've seen for the local space density is 10 to the minus 5.
That sounds about right, yeah.
But all the way out to the end of their life for a 10 giga year population. And that's comparable to CVs then.
So the
if that's true, that's right.
This here is the entire galaxy.
Sorry?
This is the highest number.
It's the most recent number I've seen.
Are you talking from roll-ups?
Roll-ups.
Okay. Yeah, so that's an observationally constrained number as opposed to expectations from theory. So, but to another answer to the question is this histogram is the entire galaxy. And LISA will see a good fraction of those systems. And the reason you turn over here is actually, let me not say that. 1,000. Okay, so I don't think this is actually the background. In any case, the point is about 10,000 AMCVNs will be detected by LISA. So those are pretty good statistics. So this would be a factor of 10 more than the upcoming optical surveys. So once you have this type of sample, the question is, what can you do with it?
Can you actually, you know, figure out that, I mean, will you have 10,000 sources that you know are these systems, or
you have 10,000 sources in this
maybe
period,
100,000 other sources, and you
well,
already know
these. So that's a good question. So this is the outward going AMCVN. So there will be some number of systems that are still moving in towards contact, and so they're essentially, you know, there's two populations that will be moving through this period space. Okay, so we do need to understand both the pre-contact and the post-contact distribution.
I guess maybe my question is more simple from, you know, from the perspective of someone who hasn't looked at these calculations,
yeah.
And that's when you have a source with LISA,
mm-hmm.
What can you determine about it? I mean,
yes.
Do you know an orbital period?
You know its frequency, and you know its frequency very well.
Okay, so the frequency is important. That gives you an orbital period, right? And the strain, can that be directly related to, say, the mass ratio, the total mass?
No, because you have distance also, right? You don't know the distance to the systems. If you see, and you can say it's pure GR, evolution, if you can see a frequency derivative, then you can get the chirp mass.
Okay.
And then that will tell you sort of distance, location. On the other thing you can get is a rough location on the sky, because LISA is going to be processing in a direction. So the thing that's, and this is why I'll be focusing on the period later on this talk, I'll be focusing on the number distribution as a function of orbital period. LISA will give you the frequency very, very precisely. So if a mission of 1 year, basically the frequency of resolution is 1/1 year.
Right. But probably not the frequency derivative, right?
It depends on the sources. Yeah, but most of these sources you will not see the chirp. And I should caveat that even if you see the chirp, you have to be very careful about whether you can say you're actually seeing pure GR evolution, or if there's other effects coming in terms of either mass transfer or maybe tidal interactions between the components, et cetera. So.
But say, so for example, suppose you had the carbon-oxygen white dwarfs.
Right.
You know, they're at the point yet where you're not predicting that they're going to merge.
Yes.
Would that be a background? To what extent would neutron star systems, which expect to be less frequent?
Neutron star systems are not going to contaminate this at any level. That's probably important. The white dwarf, and all the various forms are going to be the population you're seeing at these orbital periods. And so that's exactly what I was talking about in terms of the inspiraling system. There will be CO-CO white dwarfs, there will be CO-helium white dwarfs, there'll be proto-AMCVNs prior to contact that aren't included in this histogram. But the point is that you've got this, you'll have 10,000 plus systems, so you can start playing games in which you try to, based on just population statistics and the distribution of periods, for example, try to understand which systems are contributing in this into the integrated signal. So there is an open question as to how well you can do that, right? But you know, at the very least, I've got 10,000 systems to play with, so that's much better than 16. All right. So again, so what can you do with this? Well, the first, I want to focus on the post-contact evolution throughout the rest of this talk. The first thing to note is that what I am at contact, or those initial parameters at contact, actually are carried through in terms of the post-contact evolution. By that I mean that I can actually tell based on the growth, or I can tell the difference, I can tell the difference between a hot white dwarf. So again, this is not a fully degenerate object, it's just an object that hasn't never ignited helium. In terms of its overall evolution path, and here I'm showing its evolution in radius versus mass. So you make contact here, evolve down in radius for a bit, and then start doing your expansion phase. A hot, massive white dwarf versus, the quintessential, cold, fully degenerate object. You can see that there's a difference in the radius evolution as a function of mass. So you can also tell the difference between if I was a object that never burnt helium to an object that was burning helium at contact. And even within that channel, you can tell the difference. There's signatures of the difference between whether I barely had a chance to burn helium or whether I was burning almost all the way through to a pure CO core. And as most of us know in the room, once you have mass transfer, the structure of the donor completely determines the orbital period. So if you know the mass radius evolution, you know the orbital period evolution of the system as a function of mass. And so here I show the corresponding tracks in orbital period space for these corresponding, and again, obviously the differences here translate into differences here. So this is important because that also translates into the time evolution of the orbital period. Okay. So once you have mass transfer going on, if you wanted to ask the question of what P dot is, P orb dot, depends on two terms. One is the gravity wave driving due to angular momentum loss, and then the other is what's the mass transfer rate. So the evolution of these two terms as you proceed in your mass transfer determines how you move through orbital period derivative versus orbital period space. And so what I'm showing here is for exactly those same tracks, the inward, which is shown by dashed lines, versus outward evolution in orbital period space. So all of this is post-contact. For comparison, if you were to ask the question of, if I'm just point masses evolving at constant mass equal to constant mass is equal to the initial component masses of these tracks, what would I be doing in terms of this P dot versus P orb? And this is shown by, so this is basically the pure GRN spiral from the same initial conditions for these two tracks and this one blue dotted line for this track. I don't show it for here. So you can see, obviously, once you have mass transfer, your inward evolution rate is decreased, as you'd expect from a system with mass ratio where M2 is less than 1M1. But also, these orbital period minimums depend on your initial conditions. And the reason why that is going to be important, so let me step back one second and say that also at these orbital periods, the evolution time for these systems are no more and less, significantly less than 10 to the 7 years. So if you're looking in this orbital period space at a snapshot of what's going on in the galaxy, this is in steady state.
Can I ask another question about the orbital evolution?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's evidence or reason to believe that there could be mass ejection during some of this, which would, of course, change that equation.
Yes.
Or I don't know if Jim is here, but in this issue, if you do have some kind of nova-like activity,
right,
there could even be some epoch where it's effectively like a common envelope. So in other words, another sink for angular momentum.
Yes.
It seems to me that both of these would kind of accelerate the evolution.
Yes. So no, that's completely correct. What I'm showing here is angular momentum due to GR only conservative mass transfer. All that other bit of physics that you're talking about are actually the perturbations on this you would like to be able to probe. So think of this as me trying to provide an overview of, if you did the simplest thing and life is just being kind to you, what would you expect to see? Then differences from that are what you are trying to determine the physics, or you're interested in the physics that determines that. Yeah. Okay, so steady state. So in steady state, if you wanted to ask the question of what's the number distribution, or the number density as a function of orbital period, then if you were to say I have a population of essentially objects that all make contact with exactly the same parameters along this track, for example, right? The number distribution, the number density contributed by this particular track goes as the orbital period evolution, p dot to the minus one. So the point here is that as you go through the orbital period minimum, p dot goes through to zero. And so it just as in classical CVs, at the period minimum, you expect a spike in the number density of systems at each track. Okay. So this peak is something that will be an obvious feature in a large enough sample of systems, if you have a large enough sample of systems at these orbital periods. So to emphasize this, what I'm showing here is the number per small period bin. So each of these bins are 6 seconds, which is much larger than the resolution of LISA. So this type of, if you have enough systems, this type of binning is perfectly fine. It'll give you the statistics you need. So what I'm showing here, let's just focus on the upper plot, is the integration of that number density across each bin width for a population of white dwarf, a white dwarf donor coming into contact. Let me back out 1 second just so I can make sure I'm saying this clearly. So let's focus on this dark blue line. This dark blue line represents the steady state distribution for a single set of initial conditions, right? So these are basically the delta function in terms of the parameter, initial parameters, contributions to the overall distribution you would expect for a collection of systems coming into contact. So the point here is that in steady state, you pick up these large peaks in the number distribution. Just as a sanity check, you can ask the question, I know my population is not composed exclusively of systems coming into contact with these parameters, right? The real population or the real distribution these we'll see will be an integration over all of these and many more initial parameters. But you can to make an estimate of, so there's this peak here, do you expect to see it? Well, we expect about, I'm going to forget the numbers, but you can play the game of saying, I know the relative ratio of systems coming into contact with, for example, an entropy. So this is cold donors to hot donors up here, with an entropy of this or above. And then I know the relative frequency based on the theory I have currently of the systems below here. So if you just do the proper weighting, you'll shift these peaks and these systems up a certain factor. But the point there is that if you play that game, you'll still see this peak above that signal. Okay, so you're not gonna see just the outward moving. You know, so if everything was coming into contact, immediately reversing, going out, you basically everything would fall along this track, and then you just multiply by the total number of systems. Right? So there's structure here that you'll expect to be able to see. Like, say that confusingly enough for people to completely not get it. Right. Okay. So, again, the minimum period peaks will provide an obvious feature that should diagnose which systems. Okay, so the other point to make is that if I come into contact and then slow down, stop, and move back out, and all the systems in that with those parameters do that, right, then you end up producing this peak. If for some reason, some other physics I haven't talked about yet, I come into contact and I just drive myself into the merger, well, you're not going to end up picking up the systems that are coming back out, right? So these contributions won't happen. So if you can somehow figure out which systems are actually contributing to the morphology of the histogram up here, then you can start asking questions of which systems are surviving contact versus which systems are not, either for merger or for some other reason. So this is at least the first cut, the type of question you'll be able to answer just from looking at this histogram is which systems survive, which systems don't, is a binary. Okay. So key questions involve what physics will this probe, getting to what Roseanne was saying. And then two, you know, okay, so we can play this game, but then how constraining will a Lisa observation of this population actually be? And so Lev, Heisen-Ellemans, and I are working on this in terms of basically doing the first thing of integrating over expected initial conditions in all these populations to see, you know, what will the histogram look like and what can you say about if you make these cuts or those cuts, what will happen. So now I want to move on to actually discussing at least a few things about what physics could you probe. So the first thing is the stability of mass transfer at contact. Okay, so in the white dwarf channel, you end up making contact at a close enough configuration so that if you ask the question of what happens to the accretion stream coming out of the inner Lagrange point and follow its ballistic trajectory, that trajectory actually intersects the accretor directly. So this is important because if you don't do that, the disk or the stream will swing around, self-intersect, shock, and form a disk. And once you have a disk, then you have relatively efficient tidal interactions between the outer regions of the disk and the donor that basically allows you to feed back angular momentum carried by the stream back into the orbit. Okay. Whereas if you don't form a disk, then you end up sinking that angular momentum into the increased spin of the accretor. And then if you want to feed that angular momentum back into the orbit, you have to rely on tidal interactions between the accretor and the donor, or the accretor and the donor, which may or may not be efficient. Okay. So the reason this is important is that if you have an additional angular momentum sink, then your stability criteria in terms of am I doing stable mass transfer or not changes. And it acts to destabilize the mass transfer. Okay. So systems that in those prior slides, I would have said, based on just conservative mass transfer, J dot being only equal to the GR rate, I would have said are stable and survive contact mass transfer. When you actually take into account the potential of not efficiently interacting donor accretor with direct impact, many of those systems, or I would say most of the systems in this channel, would be unstable.
What's the expectation for R sub H?
It's not an expectation, it's a parameterization of...
Okay, I understand, but if it's zero, then all of this is not interesting.
So it's not zero. You can, follow the ballistic stream and calculate what's the angular momentum of the particles hitting. So it's a little bit hard to find.
Okay.
That's not the question. The question...
So you can actually calculate our...
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah. Okay. So stable or unstable. But again, there is the uncertain, you know, how efficiently am I coupled? So there's potentially an additional term in all of this that has to do with how rapidly can I feed angular momentum back due to tidal interactions. So answering Roseanne's question of why COCL white dwarfs are expected to merge, most of the systems in with a lower mass helium white dwarf are expected to go unstable via this mechanism. The COC white dwarfs are, suffer the same issue, and most of them should just, most of them should suffer instabilities, whether they merge or not. For the next couple slides, we'll assume if you suffer a mass transfer stability, you merge. Okay, you're done.
I guess, though, I mean, it's the same question that comes in when you're looking at type 1A supernovae via the other route, right? Which is, you know, single degenerates. Mm-hmm. When mass comes on, now here it's actually hitting the accretor, but it comes on, and the question is, how much of it can be gotten rid of with what kind of angular momentum loss?
Right.
Or maybe even some of it's gotten rid of earlier on. So there exist in principle lots of physically reasonable ways to save the system.
Except we don't see any data for winds, right? And it's also
I gotta be, it's sub-Eddington, but you have to be careful. I've heard some rumors of observations, UV observations of AMCVN itself that show peak Sydney profiles. So there might
that's
be some dis-
that's a 17 minute system.
Right. And so this is not coming into contact. But just in principle, there might be stuff coming off and on.
But you're going to show the direct impact observations, right?
No.
So there's two systems that probably are doing this that we know of.
But no, I'm not.
So this is just not. I mean,
and you can distinguish between stable versus
unstable. No. I mean, there's two systems where you see an X-ray hotspot that's pulsed.
But there's that. Those two systems account for the 16 or 18. So or there's some uncertainty. Okay. So great. You have some systems that are unstable. What can that tell you potentially about which systems? Or is there a cut in terms of initial parameters that determine whether you survive or don't if this mass transfer instability is operating, which it should be in most systems? So this is a very busy slide that I'm not going to go through in any real detail. The point is that depending on whether your donor is hot or you have a more massive accretor, there's a difference in whether or not you ever hit the stability or instability at all. So the magic line here is this Q crit. So there's some critical Q value that determines whether you're stable or not. So Q over Q crit, this line of one determines if I stay above this in the course of evolution, I'm unconditionally stable at all times. And this is just not an issue. You'll survive, period. I shouldn't say that. You'll survive based on this cut. So you can see that most of these systems, the evolution proceeds down in this direction, that most of these systems don't make that cut. And so you'd expect all of these, and potentially this one here also, to undergo an instability and assume, you know, merge. Whereas there are a few systems up here that will survive based on the fact that I'm hotter and I have a more massive accretor. So the reason this hotter donors and more massive accretors, well, more massive accretor lowers your Q. So you tend to be more stable just because I have a higher or a lower mass ratio. The hotter donors, the reason they're, the reason why entropy is important is that one part of this stability criteria is this term here, which I didn't really talk through, which is essentially how rapidly do I expand or contract upon mass loss. If I expand rapidly upon mass loss, I tend to be less stable. So hot donors tend to not expand as rapidly at their maximum expansion rate, okay, which happens down here, relative to cold donors. Okay. So that's the physics setting this. So if unstable mass transfer actually does produce mergers, then the PR distribution will reflect this lack of outward contribution of systems with colder donors and less massive accretors. So if we were to go back to those histograms that I'm showing, you would see, you know, at some orbital period, basically normal inward contribution, and then a very steep peak probably at the lowest, at an orbital period reflecting of the lowest entropy that survives. Right? So that would be a very, crisp signal in the LISA data. And again, we have to go through and actually integrate and check, you know, which systems survive and then integrate the distribution contributions over all of these initial parameters. The other thing that you might be able to say, or constraining is the efficiency of coupling in with these white dwarf binaries in spiraling. So one of the things that determines whether you're stable or not that we don't have a good handle on is the efficiency of coupling. So if you have more efficient coupling, more of these systems will survive the cut. And from first principles, you know, the tidal coupling efficiency is, you know, orders of magnitudes in terms of uncertainty. So LISA might be able to place a handle on that. Another point of that, though, is that if you're a person who's interested in, you know, doing something with GR based on inspiraling detached systems, and you assume I only have GR going on, then you'll get a certain answer to some certain questions. If, however, you're being, you know, fooled by the fact that there are efficient, there is a relatively efficient coupling in terms of tidal interactions between these inspiraling white dwarfs, you're going to get a different answer. So you need to understand, in terms of playing games with GR, if you have, even in the detached state, something that is large enough to, you know, screw around with the orbital period evolution. Okay, so, oh geez, this is going on. I was actually at a half hour for the GR people. Okay, so the other thing I want to talk about is the mass transfer rate evolution and ignition of accreted helium on the surface of the white dwarf. So during all phases of the mass transfer rate in these systems is evolving. In the occurrence of, so I'll just go through this. So let's see, I should actually move this point up. During the early phases of the evolution of these systems, so basically at contact and slightly beyond, the mass transfer rates are at such a level that you actually will probe helium accretion and helium ignition physics on the surface of the white dwarf. Okay? So you can get ignition of helium on the white dwarf in these systems during the early phases of evolution. Okay, then going back up here, so there's been some recent work that that suggests, okay, so you do an instability, right? But just because you have an instability doesn't necessarily mean you end up shearing the lower mass object into a disk and accreting all of it. You can actually evolve through the instability, so you have a phase of extremely high, you know, mass transfer. So this is 10 times at E10 in this particular example, but no account being taken of the fact that you're doing extremely super E10 evolution. But it's just as a for sort of an example of the point. So as you go through this instability, at some point, you've reversed that mass ratio, or you've reduced the mass ratio to the point where you're no longer unstable. And so, you know, that's all that's going on. So as long as you can maintain your integrity as a donating object in terms of, you know, I can actually stay bound, then you will evolve out of this instability and back down. Okay. So, you know, there's a lot of questions about what happens up here, right? Okay, but let's just run with this in terms of, you know, let's say you can survive that. Well, even in that case, there's going to be a significant difference in the mass transfer rate evolution as a function of time, you know, that will play into, you know, what happens to the accreted helium on the surface of the white dwarf. And now, finally, I get to a plan I actually belong here, as I showed the MODIS plot. Right, so we've all seen this plot before, and the point is just to say that different mass transfer rates probe different accretion or different ignition physics. So if you're up here, let's just say up here, you're doing stable burning and expanding your envelope to red giant proportions. Whereas down below this point, you expect essentially helium shell flashes and nova. And in the MODOS version of the story, if you don't lose that mass, all you're doing is processing it to CNO. So eventually you're able to build up a large enough white dwarf that you do a center deflagration. Once you get down below another magic number, the accretion physics sets a detonation of helium off center. And then finally, once you get down low enough, if you have enough mass in the system, you'll just essentially, you know, grow the Chandrasekhar mass and, you know, go again, carbon deflagration. But the thing to note is that all of these calculations are done assuming you have infinite helium at constant mass transfer rate, right? Which, you know, in most of the cases I'm talking about is not a good approximation. So one thing that we need to be aware of and to quantify is how do outcomes vary when you consider involving helium mass transfer rate in a real, the context of a real system? So what I show here is m dot versus the accreted layer mass. And so you also, I should mention, although I'm not going to quantify anything on this next plot, you obviously need to accrete a certain amount of helium before you ignite. And that ignition mass, or the accreted layer mass that you need, increases as you go down in mass transfer rate. So you can basically here, flash, at a high enough accretion rate, flash several times very rapidly because you only need, maybe 0.1 or less of helium on the surface. Okay. So that's sort of the motivation of this, obviously. So you need to accrete at least some minimum value of helium, which depends also on your mass transfer rate. So the point of this slide is that depending on the nature of the donor at contact, whether you're a white dwarf-like object or a helium-burning star, and also depending within each of those different channels on the exact properties, so this would be cold to hot in terms of colder donors at contact, versus warmer donors at contact, and then this varies, your helium fraction left in the system for the helium star. So blue lines show the white dwarf-like donors calculated by myself and Ron Tam, and then these red lines are courtesy of Lev Yunkelson for stars that are burning helium at contact. All right. So you can see there's a significant difference in the morphology of these curves. And depending on where you're sitting in terms of formation channel and particular properties, you probe different regions of this accretion or this ignition physics. So, for example, white dwarf donors, many of them could just end up doing stable helium burning indoor, evolving down through weak flashes. And some of them will probe, as Lars has pointed out recently and talked about at the conference, a regime in which you expect to get edgelet detonations. And so, for comparison, these lines are calculated with an accretor mass of 0.7, and then these solid black squares are calculations by, Weaver and Woosley, but I might be getting, but basically real calculations of at constant m dot with exactly the same mass. These all went supernova. So you can see that several of these tracks go straight through where you expect things to blow up. If you have enough helium left over after doing these flashes, et cetera. So there's, is there some hysteresis going from here to here that changes the outcome or not? And that's an open question. And then you can see that the constant m dot almost, these tracks or this some channels where the constant m dot assumption came from, is that as you move during the early phases of the mass transfer rate, transfer evolution, you basically set at almost constant m dot before you do this sort of turnaround and then move back out. Okay. So all of that is to say, is going back to make contact with these histograms, is the question of, if you take all this into account, which systems will actually survive as a binary, and which systems do you do supernova explosions where you get rid of the accretor? And at what point in the evolution does that occur? So if you're doing supernova over here, right, you've already done the turnaround in p-orb space. And so you'll produce a peak, but then your system will be no longer part of the population further out. So there is both this the question of, where and when does this occur?
So Chris, I think we need to wrap up.
Okay, this is my summary.
This is good.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Gotcha.
When you say supernova, do you really mean in the sense of possible Chandrasekhar mass supernova?
I just mean something that blows. I just mean a detonation of, So actually, if I can comment on that question, in that a lot of these things are probably not going to look like type 1As. But we have a very particular binary evolution channel that we know systems come from. We see AMCBNs, we see they survive contact. We are starting to get some handle on which systems survive, which systems don't. We know the progenitors of other systems that don't survive have got to be being formed in some number. You blow these things up. Okay. They might not look like type 1As, but it's the same physics, it's the same accretion, it's the same considerations that determine whether they survive or not. The question is, you'll have once you do this work, you'll have a prediction for things that might not look like type 1As, but have got to be there. All right? So, trying to expand the
are we looking for type 1As, you know, into, let's look for things that go boom. And what can we learn about the accretion physics, the nuclear physics, et cetera, you know, that maybe we can leverage into understanding what type 1As that we're using for cosmology are actually doing, would be sort of, you know, my humble plea to the community to, you know, maybe if we can broaden our scope, if there is something to broaden to, would be something that would be useful in terms of understanding all of the physics I'm talking about, and maybe even inform 1As.
I'd like to ask a general question about LISA. Is the noise floor of observations instrumental, or is it unresolved sources?
It depends on which orbital period you're talking about, or which frequency you're talking about. So the slide for that is, where's the slide for that? That one. So it depends, and also depends on what your expected signal to noise and what duration of mission is. So in this plot, you're basically signal to noise of one detection limit is all instrumental in duration, whereas this line represents the foreground of detached systems. If you're to do, if you can expect a signal to noise of 5, or you do a longer mission, then this thing drops down, and then you start probing this. So over here at the high frequencies, it's all instrumental, yeah, et cetera. This is, you know, photon shot noise essentially, and I think this is starting to probe the size of the detector itself in terms of arm length.
And so in terms of the foreground, are AM CVNs a dominant foreground?
No. In terms of foreground, proto AM CVNs are things that will never become AM CVNs because they're CO white dwarfs are the dominant foreground. These are all just detached white dwarf systems. Yeah. Now the AMCVNs are the interesting things you want to look at. Well, thank you.
Good. Thanks.